C1A, number 12B.
And that spiritual quality has in itself, like a seed, has in itself the whole tree, has in itself the whole of mind, all the faculties of mind, all the qualities of mind. And so we begin to realize in prayer, in this scientific prayer, that we don't, that it isn't a question of adding together qualities, of seeing that I must have these qualities, and then I must have that qualities, and that quality. No, it is more than that. Every time we take the standpoint of the Word as the Word, we at once set into motion the whole of being. We set into motion the whole of being. And the moment we touch an idea or a quality of mind, like seeking, we set in motion the whole of mind. We can, in being, we can never separate being. We can never split up being into parts. And so that gives us that assurance and certainty and trust that we see that if we approach God in the right way, that is, if we approach mind through the ideas of mind, we approach spirit through the ideas of spirit, and soul through the ideas of spirit, and so on, that we touch the whole of being, and therefore that the whole of being begins to operate on us. Well, that's an aspect of prayer. Seeing now, for instance, that only the godlike can pray aright, that only the godlike can have access to God, to the whole of God, I begin to realize that that which prays, really prays, is the kingdom of God in me. That the divine in me is looking out and reaching out to God. And so I get that sense that the divine is asking for the divine and is supplied by the divine. It is never a problem or error or anything that tries to reach the divine. There is nothing like the condemnation of mortals to till the ground. It's always right from the standpoint of the unity of God and man. Right from the beginning of the textbook sounds through that sense that God and man is one. And it shows itself through those qualities that the divine mind and desire is one. That through the divine desire and holy desire, I am one with the divine mind. That through spiritual qualities, I am one with spirit. That through sincerity and the willingness to reject the fault, I am one with soul, and so on. And so right from the beginning, I start from the unity of God and man, of God and his universe of divine quality. That's prayer. But is it enough to see that? Is it enough to see that way to God? No, it isn't enough. That's why after prayer comes the chapter of Atonement and Eucharist, and takes that unity that which is stated in prayer and says, yes, but that unity must be exemplified. Says atonement is the exemplification of man's unity with God, whereby man reflects divine truth, life, and love. It must be exemplified. And so the demand comes in and says, all that what has been presented in prayer of the unity of God and man must be exemplified in our everyday life. It demands the exemplification. Well, the moment I begin to exemplify something, I must dis-exemplify the contrary. If I exemplify my unity with God, I must dis-exemplify, if you want to say so, my unity with anything else. So atonement comes and says, yes, show through your example, through exemplification, whatever the example may be, show through your example that you really testify and be that to which you profess yourself in prayer. That which in prayer was our attitude, show it forth. And by showing it forth, I must show forth but I don't anymore have a unity with something else. So we get atonement and Eucharist. Atonement which says, be one in your exemplification with mind and spirit and soul and principle and life and truth and love, and disidentify yourself with any other unity. That's the Eucharist. Lay down every false exemplification. Lay down every false unity. Lay down, therefore, our unity with a human mind. Lay down our unity with material purposes of life. Lay down your unity with that what your senses tell you. Fourth, it says, lay down that unity where you always act according to human doctrines, theological doctrines, and so on. And fifth, it says, lay down your unity with the world's sense of life, with the material sense of life. Lay it down. Exemplify it. That's how far we came last time. So, can you see how the first chapter begins to demand the second chapter? In the first chapter, we still to some extent can pray and do the wrong thing. In the second chapter must come in and say, but that which has been presented as prayer and which has shown ourselves an inward divine spiritual attitude, atonement comes and says, don't deny that when the winds blow. Says, that inward attitude which in prayer we have found in prayer, it says, keep to that, stick to that, find yourself to that, so that when the winds blow, when the trouble comes, when persecution comes, when difficulties come, when opposition comes, when other arguments come, that you don't give in, that you don't give way to those, and that you don't deny the Christ. The Christ, the word of the Christ comes in and says, stick to your word. That's the Christ which comes to the world. So the word as the Christ says, that which in the word of the word I have seen to be the right way out, prayer shows me the right way out, says, stick to that. Don't give in anymore. Bind yourself to that and therefore have the strength to free yourself from other ties. So in prayer, we had that first lovely touch of God as the seven synonymous terms, that lovely touch of the divine nature. And so atonement Eucharist comes in and says, bind those lovely touches, bind those stronger and stronger to God. And in binding them stronger and stronger to God, you must prove that unity with God. You must prove through exemplification your unity with God. How, in the face of temptation by disidentifying ourselves with all that stands against God. That's our Eucharist. That's the cup we have to drink. That here comes the demand that all the temptations which come against us, that we are facing them and rejecting them through exemplification. Not like in the prayer, in the third prayer, to reject them in thought and have the willingness to reject them in thought, but to exemplify it indeed. So whenever I pray, and whenever I pray aright, I always come to the point of unity with God, of at one moment with God. I always, if I pray aright, I find always my unity with God, because praying aright means that which is already of the nature of God in me looks at God, desires God, and seeks God. And that brings me to the unity with God. But that unity, that one man, that one mind with God, asks of me and demands of me the Eucharist, the laying down of the wrong. Therefore, we have that scriptural note where it says, those and they that are Christ have crucified the flesh with the affections and lusts. See, she says, or the Bible text says, they that are Christ have. She doesn't say must. Bible says, doesn't say must crucify their flesh, or ought to, or should, or have to. It is a fact they have. See, how can we already, right at the beginning of the second chapter, have that standpoint? only because prayer has preceded. Prayer has led us to conceive of a unity with God, the world sense of it. We have seen there that if we use those divine qualities in us, which reflect mind and spirit, soul and principle and life and truth and love in us, we have found our unity with God. They that are Christ, that's Christ, they have crucified the flesh with all the affections and lusts. It is the moment can you see that? The moment we have inwardly in prayer that unity with God, we have it. We don't, there is no other must to it. We have it. And we can't, it shows that we can't have it, or that we have it, because through prayer we have to some sense purified our conscience. That's why Paul in that passage said, walk in the Spirit, and ye shall not fulfill the lust of the flesh. It says, walk in the Spirit, then we are Christ, and we can no more fulfill the lust of the flesh. Then we have crucified them. When we can't fulfill them anymore, we have crucified them. So I just want to show the comfort which we get out of this textbook, because religious teaching or moral teaching is always in another way. Moral teaching always says, you should do this and that, and you shouldn't do this and that, and you must do this and that, and you mustn't do this and that. It's always a moral effort and a moral demand implied. But here it's always a divine demand implied, and always a divine effort implied. It's always from the point of grace. Right from the beginning of the textbook, it's from the point of grace of man's unity with God. In prayer, we find this unity. Through prayer, we find and establish within us that unity. And we have it. And in atonement, we only have to exemplify it, to use that unity and show that it is foolproof, that it is watertight, that no other temptation can break that unity. So can you see what I want to point out? I want just to give a good kick to religious thought in us, which always says, oh, I ought to, may I be strong enough to do it. I should do this and this. May I be strong enough to do it. That's religious teaching. Scientific teaching is different. That's why we have that order, first of the Word as the Word, and only then the Word as the Christ. That's the love of it, that it first gives us the gentle unity on which we can base and which we can have. Everybody can have those seven aspects of prayer. Everybody can have it. Everybody can see. Everybody can just love what he sees. Everybody can just be sincere in that what he loves seeking. And everybody just can be principled in that what he sees. And everybody just can put his whole heart and life into it in what he sees. And everybody just can stick to that in an affirmative way and affirm that through thin and thick, as we say in German. I think you say through hell and high water or something like that. See, and everyone just can adore and put his whole trust in that. Prayer doesn't demand something supernatural, something superhuman. And so atonement Eucharist comes in and says, so fundamentally, you are Christ. And being Christ, you have crucified the flesh with the affections and lusts. And the only thing you have to do is now to preach the gospel. And preaching the gospel meant to prove it through daily living, that you are Christ. Not through baptism, through living the gospel. Through proving in everyday life, exemplifying that you have that grace of the Christ. And so this will nurture and sustain a divine sense of life. And you will no more drink the cup until you drink it anew in the kingdom of God. So atonement Eucharist really should be for us a gentle and loving sense, and not a sense of ought and must and may I have power and the strength and the courage and I don't know what to fulfill the demand. If we fall back on prayer, we always will find the necessary substance, the necessary power and strength to exemplify in atonement Eucharist in what we believe. Let me perhaps compare quickly the scriptural notes of prayer with that of Atonement Eucharist, to see that they are one thing, that they link together, that they are not scriptural notes which somehow we have to learn by heart, and that if we have learned them by heart, that we are saved. But that there is a wonderful logical sequence in that whole touch, especially if we take the meaning of how Mrs. Eddy, through the chapter, brings out the tone of these scriptural notes. It was in the word of the word, it was mind, spirit, soul. Meaning what? Meaning, as we have seen, that it means desiring, mind, desiring what? To know God as He is. But desire is not enough. It says, do I make that desire my whole being? Do I take that into my ark? Do I take that in and conceive of it? Do I put all my best qualities into it? And so we always get that sense, seeking is not enough, striving, laboring for it enables us to end. And we have seen that if we put all the best qualities into that seeking, that those spiritual qualities of striving, struggling, laboring for it, that then always something happens, just as in the 3,000 year. Always Abraham, Jacob, Joseph, and Moses, Joshua, began to hear something. They became the representative of God. Something in them began to speak and to become the representative of God. But becoming the representative, you see that soul, becoming the representative of soul, something speaking in us says what? And now the demand of the Christ comes in. At the 3.5, always we have the crucial point. Soul has always those two sides, the world side and the Christ side. Begins to talk to us and says to us, just as it said to Abraham, get out of Ur in Chaldee. Get out of the old. Becomes a demand, becomes a forcible command, which says, get out of the old rut. And so spiritual sense in prayer then begins to talk to us and says, I can't have anything more material sense speaking. Put it out. And so we come to Atonement Eucharist, which starts again with soul, and then principle life with soul, which says, crucify the thing that is not of God, must be put away, and will be put away. And inward in us, the Christ in us, puts it away. It is no more a moral effort. And in putting away, it says, you see, not what your egoistic mind wants to accomplish in your life is right, but what principle wants to do with you is right. Obey principle. Principle won't obey you. You have to obey principle. For what? What will principle do to me? And so life comes always in and says, principle says, I am life. That which is principled must be brought out, must come to life, must be expressed. And that's the real life. That is life which comes and flows from principle. And so you have that sense that you will no more drink of the cup of bitterness until I drink it anew as the cup of rejoicing in the kingdom of God, as the new sense of life in the kingdom of God. I would like you to see that order very clearly. It's a spiritual order, it's not a mental order, it's not an order which we can think out. It's a spiritual order. What is this spiritual order? Always, as it is in the days of creation, as it is in the 1,000-year period, and here exemplified through the scriptural notes of the word of the word, linking up to the word of the Christ, always this. Principally, in principle, always this. And this is the pith and the depth of what we are learning. It's always this. It's mind. What mind says, I must seek. I must seek with all my heart. I think I said it wrong. That must I don't like. It's inward in us something that seeks. Somehow we can't say, I must seek. Something in us is, because mind just can't help but speak in every one of us, in some a bit louder, in some stronger, and some a bit quieter, is a sense seeking, longing to find God as He is. If we take that, let there be light in us, that sense of reaching out for the light in us, if we take that and are humble enough and gentle enough and loving enough and take that into us, conceive of it. We take that into our heart and just think, well, that's the most valuable thing that ever can happen. That thing which longs for God is the most substantial thing on earth that ever is, because it is out for God, and God is the all, and God is the eternal, the bigger thing. And as I begin to ponder that, and love it, and ponder it, and think about it, and value it, and cherish it, and adore it, and have all my affection in it, something happens in us. The third invariably happens, that something begins to speak in us, that spiritual sense. The order of God, not our order, is at work. These 7 days are God's order, not our order. And therefore God is at work. And so it begins to speak in us in all sorts of ways. May give us a sense of satisfaction, may give us a sense of calmness and peace, may give us a sense of joy, of happiness, a sense of having found. And so it begins that we feel that something in us represents God. Soul is never without its representative. Something in us represents God. But that representative begins to talk, and we come to the Christ, word of the Christ, and says, yes, I am your comforter. I bring you satisfaction. I bring you this joy and peace, and I keep it for you, but I can't have anything contrary to me. That must go out. It comes to Abraham and says, get out of Ur. And it came to all the patriarchs and said, get away from the old rut. Go forward. Go and wander. And so comes something speaks in us, and by itself, that divine in us begins to push out of our consciousness what is not right. It begins to uncover in our consciousness that which is not right, and pushes it out, begins to reject it, and begins to oust it out, you see. And as it ousts it out, it says, yes, that's right. It says, because that representative in you is your principal, is your commander. You have to obey that. And then comes something into our life which just says, I'm no more going to obey anything but that inner small voice, that spiritual sense. I'm no more going to take anything as my principal, as that which is the representative of God. And one just can't anymore obey to anything else. So you get to principle.
And what does that sense say? It says, anyone going out there says that this spiritual sense in us longs to obey that principle. It says, yes, if I obey that representative in me, I am ushered into an absolutely new life, into a divine sense of life. No more in that sense of life which I wanted to live, which I thought out to live, which I wanted, I imagined what life may be. But principle takes me and says, I push forward now.